to him make me nervous. Give me a break.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Therapist Kelly, and my co-host, Dr. Deborah Mandel, is having an amazing birthday at Magic Mountain today. So I have an incredible fill-in guest host, Kathy Lewis Edgerton. She's in the entertainment business. Just kidding.
That's
we were talking about how to introduce her. So Kathy's going to be my fill-in. She's also a lovely friend and one of my crazier friends, which makes for a perfect co-host. And I wanted to share with our audience kind of a crazy story that happened a few weeks ago. Thank God for Kathy. So I'm a pretty tame person overall, except I decided last weekend or the weekend before to, for the first time, to try a marijuana edible. Because, you know, I have anxiety, which segues into our guests later on, but I decided to try, you know, cookie. People talk about it all the time, no biggie. So I'm getting ready for both of my children's school gala event, where there'll be 600 people, and decide, yeah, sure, I'll just try this.
Which is the perfect time to do that.
Yeah, right? Brilliant.
For the first time.
Brilliance on my part. So I decide I'm meeting Kathy and her husband for dinner, and I'm waiting because Kathy's always late. And
thank you.
So I have the cookie. I take half, and I say, there was a moment of clarity of, like, maybe I should just do the half. No. I'll just go for the whole thing. Why not?
This was before I got there, by the way, just to be clear, to give me some kudos for being a friend.
Yeah, exactly. So I do this at, like, 5:15. Kathy shows up probably 5:45. So still nothing. I'm totally normal. 6:15, it hit. No, maybe it was like closer to 6:30. Hits me like a ton of bricks. And thank God for Kathy, because I was like, Kathy, I'm losing my mind. Save this cookie wrapper. We're going to need it for the hospital. I'm going to be going into hallucination mode. Like, I don't know what's going on. I couldn't go home. I didn't want to see my kids. I was terrified. So Kathy's like, go to my place. Then she starts telling me details. Here's the code, how you get it. I'm like, I see your mouth moving. I don't know what's going on. Talk to my husband, David. You tell him what's going on with the code and the dog, and I don't know. So I'm literally in Kathy's bed under the covers like a homeless person, borrowed her sweatpants and her T-shirt, and survived the evening, but will never, ever do it again.
Yeah, it was quite shocking to see you actually in my bed. I'm like, wow, she is super comfortable. In my bed with my dog and has my clothes on.
It was so
fantastic.
Because it's not me normally. I probably like...
No, not at all.
No.
It's not you. It was bizarre.
It was
bizarre
so
to watch.
Crazy.
And I was trying not to freak you out because I thought, good God, who does a whole cookie? Who eats an entire cookie for the first time?
Well, the best part was you kept saying, you're fine. You're fine. You're fine. You're okay. You're fine.
And I was looking at David going, I don't think she's going to be fine. No, I really don't think this is a good thing.
It's crazy, but like...
I know. You hit declined quickly.
But
it was bad.
It's good for our listeners to hear because I think that our society makes it like not a big deal. Like, oh, everybody does it. And it's like, you got to be careful with
yeah,
that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
My God.
I agree.
So,
I agree.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now you know.
Yeah, because I learned the hard way. And every time I tell people, like, oh, yeah, you shouldn't do that when you're going out. I'm like, yeah, I know. Thanks. Where were you,
yeah.
you know,
then what's the part? This is clearly something you do just to sit at home and be alone.
Yes.
I guess, and freak out by yourself. That sounds healthy, too. No thanks.
But I did watch Key and Peele, Substitute Teacher.
Oh, perfect, perfect.
It was hilarious.
Yes. Good good choice. That was your first good choice of the evening.
Exactly. A little late on the game. But. So how was your week?
It's good. It's good. If my sister does listen to this, I'm going to send her the link and make her. It's her birthday. So happy birthday, Millie. And I have a funny story and talk about anxiety as a middle child that she is. She called me last night and said, you know, recently mom and I were just kind of going through stuff and I found my baby bracelet. I just want to let you know I took my baby bracelet. I'm like, great. Great. Take your baby bracelet. And she goes, but it said May 14th on it. I'm like, what?
Date.
Like the date of birth? And she's like, yeah. my birthday is May 15th. When's my birthday? I go, I don't know. I was born after you. And she's like, what is going on? I like ran home and looked at my birth certificate to find out when my birthday was. I'm like, ouch. Like, how do you, at 55, you're questioning if your parents knew the actual day you were born?
So the main takeaway is your mom messed up.
Yeah. Pretty much. I think so. I think she just wasn't paying attention.
That's
but, you know.
Middle child, of
yes,
course.
Yes, she's the middle child. Yeah. She already had, you know. So that's what happens, I guess.
For Millie.
I mean, I don't even have one picture of myself. I'm the only. So, I mean, the youngest. The youngest. Yeah. So, God, I'd be happy if I found a picture of myself.
Oh, my God, this makes complete sense now. I never knew that you were the youngest. Now,
I was kind of raised like an only because they were all so much older.
Right.
So
oh,
there's
that's
a,
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So don't just pin me on that.
Right. So I want to give a shout out to last week's guest who is phenomenal, Jonathan Robinson. He is the author of More Love, Less Conflict. Fantastic book. If you're struggling in relationships, want to get more communication tools, it's really great. I mean, my husband actually is reading the book. This says something.
Wow,
yeah.
It does.
So
I go,
mean,
David.
He, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I mean, he's usually just on Instagram, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's about it. So we're moving on up. So, but without further ado, I'm going to introduce our amazing guest today. It's Dr. Ellen Hendrickson. She's a clinical psychologist who helps millions calm their anxiety and be their authentic selves through her award-winning podcast, Savvy Psychologist, and in her clinic at Boston University's Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. Ellen's scientifically based zero-judgment approach is regularly featured in Psychology Today, Scientific American, The Huffington Post, Susan Cain's Quiet Revolution, and many other media outlets. Savvy Psychologist, which has been downloaded over 5 million times, which is incredible, was picked as a best new podcast of 2014 on iTunes and was Auto Radio's best healthcare podcast of 2016. Ellen earned her PhD at UCLA and completed her training at Harvard Medical School. She lives in the Boston area with her family. Today, she's here to talk with us about her book, How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic, and Rise Above Social Anxiety. Welcome, Dr. Ellen.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here, Kathy and Therapist Kelly.
I hope we didn't scare you off with our craziness, although I have a feeling you've probably heard it before.
I've heard it all. Don't worry. And my week was not nearly as interesting as yours, so I enjoyed hearing yours.
So we're here today to talk a little bit about social anxiety. And so for the layperson, can you kind of give us just a broad definition of what that means to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So social anxiety is essentially self-consciousness, but on steroids. And so it's this perception that we have a fatal flaw. There's something embarrassing or deficient about us that unless we work hard to conceal or hide that fatal flaw, it will be revealed and then we'll be judged and rejected by everybody. And so a nice analogy I like to use is that we can all relate to the experience of like looking in the mirror and seeing what we think is a flaw. Like maybe we have a pimple that day, maybe we're having a bad hair day, maybe we think our butt looks big in these pants, you know. And so oftentimes we'll try to hide that. Like we'll throw on some tinted moisturizer, we'll put a hat on for the day, we'll change our pants. But if we go out, if we're not able to hide or conceal and we have to go out and do our day like that, we feel really self-conscious. We want to hide. We want to make sure nobody sees us. We might cut conversations short. And so social anxiety feels the same way, except instead of for our outside, it's for our inside. So like, for example, like in a social situation, we might think that we're awkward or we have nothing to say or we'll go blank or we'll look like an idiot or that we're turning red, that we're stupid, any of a million other perceived flaws. But the thing that makes it social anxiety is that this flaw isn't really true. Or, you know, it might be something we do struggle with, like maybe we do go blank in conversation sometimes, but it's not nearly as evident or as dire as we imagine. And so that perception and that fear of the reveal is what social anxiety is.
So does it have to do with your confidence level, per se? Like how much of it is
It can.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And like, no matter what we think that flaw is, like the result is that we avoid. And so that avoidance, which we can talk about certainly, might be overt. You know, so for instance, we might not ask a question in class because we're worried we'll look stupid. We might eat lunch at our desk, you know, rather than with our colleagues because we feel awkward. Mm-hmm. We might avoid parties because, you know, we're worried that no one really wants us there. But we also might avoid covertly. So, like, we might go to the party, but only talk to the friend we came with. Or we might spend our time scrolling through the phone. Or we might spend most of our time petting the host's dog. And so, you know, like, even if the root of social anxiety is in our confidence and is in that fear of the reveal, yeah, it's really, like, fed and watered and fertilized by avoidance. That's what maintains it.
So, Ellen, do you think some of this has to do with maturity at all? Because a couple of the things you mentioned rang true to me, but as I've grown older and gotten to an age where you kind of don't really care at some point, do you think it's...
It's so true.
I call it the don't give a shit age. Right. But, you know, is that part of evolving? Because, you know, I know we see a lot of this with millennials, and my fear, are these kids going to grow out of this and, you know, and get to a place where they don't have this type of feeling and anxiety out in the public or with friends?
Yeah. I mean, so anxiety in general tells us two lies. And the first lie is that whatever the worst case scenario that our imagination can come up with is a foregone conclusion. Like, that if we go to this party, we're going to get laughed at. If we ask for a raise, our boss will say, for you, you're an idiot, you know. Like, whatever horrible thing that our crazy brains can come up with, like, we think that is going to happen. And the second lie that anxiety tells us is that we can't handle it, that we're not capable of doing whatever this thing is that we're afraid of. And so you're absolutely right. As we get older and gather more experience, as we get more evidence under our belt that, oh, wait, when I go ahead and try this thing I'm afraid of, nothing bad happens. Or, oh, wait, that wasn't as bad as I thought. I could actually handle that. Mm-hmm. Then that allows our confidence to grow, and we can indeed outgrow mm-hmm. social anxiety. Because, I mean, confidence, I wish I could, you know, shout this from the rooftop. Confidence, so many people will come into my office and say, I wish I could just, like, retreat from the world and, like, hit pause and work on myself and gather my confidence and then hit play again and reemerge and be confident and live my life. And I always say, like, that's awesome, but can we do it in a different order? Can we have you live your life in order to build confidence? What we have to have you do is to do things before you're 100% ready, to stretch and grow just a little. You don't have to jump into the deep end of the pool. You know, you can inch into the pool, and then your confidence will catch up. So action first. Yeah. Confidence second.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. Well, let's talk a little bit about millennials and adolescents. And so I imagine, is it safe to say social anxiety is on the rise?
It is. And so at least, I work at Boston University. And so we will treat, it's a community clinic, so we treat anyone who walks through the door. But because it's university affiliated, I see a lot of college age students or like young adults. And absolutely, over the years, I have seen a rise in social anxiety. And I think it's a lot of it, I think, has to do with technology and with social media. Mm-hmm. And we can absolutely talk more about that.
I would love to talk about that because it's so funny because when I'm like in line for something, I will look around and it seems like the young kids, as if I'm some old grandma, but like
kids today. Well,
you know, I mean,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're not young.
Sadly, but I look around, and the 20-somethings are literally on their phone, and the older people are just waiting in line patiently, yeah. And so it's so interesting. It's like the younger kids haven't learned that skill of just sitting there and, you know, waiting and just looking around.
It's an appendage. It's an extension of themselves.
Totally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts around that, Ellen?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, I'm sure, you know, I use my phone just as much as anyone else. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure you use social media and, you know, like use your phone as well. I'm not anti-tech. But, and at the same time, I think that technology drives social anxiety in a bunch of ways, actually. So one, it allows us to avoid people, you know, mm-hmm. and so... So for instance, like I was in New York a few weeks ago and I was going to get on the subway and I saw this sign in the subway that said over, it was for a food delivery service, and it said over 8 million people living in New York City, and we help you avoid them all. And then, like, there was another one I saw later that day. It was for the same delivery service, and it said, everything great about eating combined with everything great about not talking to people. And so there's this sense, this is like kind of rise of people hating.
Yeah.
I think that's occurring. And, you know, I get it. People can be annoying and prejudiced and unpredictable, but, you know, people are also awesome and hilarious and caring and wonderful. And so technology is this paradox. It allows us to connect with each other through social media like never before, but it also allows us to avoid each other. We can stay in this very narrow world of our own choosing and that we have complete control over for like untold hours. And so when we avoid something, whether, you know, anything, including people, it gets built up in our mind as something big and scary. And so, like, for instance, have you ever procrastinated, you know, about something, and then when you finally did it, you're like, that was it? That's all that was? That took 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. So avoidance of people builds up those two fundamental lies of anxiety. You know, the worst case scenario is a foregone conclusion, and two, we can't deal. So when we're in this, you know, kind of world of our, you know, of our phone and our own controlled consumption that we can stay, you know, immersed in for a long time, we end up with this dearth of experience. So cumulatively, then there are fewer interactions that we can draw from. And so we don't have as much information about what is likely to happen when we actually talk to somebody, and we inevitably think it's going to be worse than it is.
Yes.
So that makes confidence shaky. We're not sure we're capable, and that in turn makes us avoid it more. So that's one thing. A second thing is, I think that typing versus talking is really different. So we've started to communicate often by text or email or social media comment.
Yep.
And so, you know, while technology is designed to like save us time and make things more convenient, what's happening in practice is that it actually gives us time to compose, to edit, mm-hmm. and to perfect.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
So speaking face to face is really different. In real time, you know, when you're talking, there's no time to compose or edit or perfect.
Uh-huh.
And so again, this is additive. If you have less experience, like you may be having hundreds of conversations a day,
right.
But if they're all over text, that's a lack of experience in speaking to someone's face that builds up. And so again, there's less experience to draw from. It remains uncertain. Mm-hmm. We assume it will go badly. We have less faith in our own ability, and then we avoid it more. So it becomes this cycle.
Yeah. And the risk of interpretation on text.
Oh,
you have to be
God.
So careful
yes.
with that as
yes.
well.
So
that's happened
true.
To me many
so
times.
True.
My husband and I struggle with that
yeah.
quite a bit.
Well, because it's like you
he
can't
thinks
read
I'm
emotion.
Telling him off, and I'm like, I what? I was just like, yeah, what are you talking about? Yeah, that's
right,
tough.
Right.
Ellen, it was interesting because you said they can make their world so narrow with technology and kind of hide from it.
Mm.
But I was thinking about millennials or kids these days, which I hate to say because it does make me feel very old.
Get off
but
my lawn.
Yeah, exactly. Well, right. I have said that too. But yeah, to me, it seems like I look at them. I'm not envious of the world they're growing up in. To me, it seems like their world is so big. When we were growing up, our world was our high school, like in our immediate mm-hmm. friends and kind of what they thought about us. And that was tough enough for
right.
some. Now their world is so global. It's, you know, they're not just exposed with social media to their high school. It's, you know, statewide, nationwide, worldwide. So I feel like although they can narrow themselves, they're so concerned outside their mm-hmm. realm. And how prepared are they when they get out, because they're spending so much time creating this image for all these, this huge world that they live in, how prepared are they to really get out in the world when they are expected to? And how do they minimize anxiety?
I'm so glad you asked that. Absolutely. Oh my gosh. So anxiety is driven by uncertainty. Like, what's going to happen? What if something bad happens? You know, what if this person laughs in my face? You know, et cetera. But we can, with the little things, we can minimize uncertainty to a great extent. So, like, if we need to go somewhere, like we program it into Google Maps, or if we're going to go to a restaurant, we look at the menu beforehand, or if we're going on vacation, we'll look at reviews for our destination. We're going to a party, we can probably see the guest list on the online invitation. And so there's less practice with uncertainty on a small scale. But like you said, like the world has gotten much more global and interconnected and bigger. Mm-hmm. But if we have less practice with uncertainty for the little things, then in a world where the uncertainty for the big things, like a career, like a stable career or finding a partner, like that is going to be really hard to tackle when we have less practice with the little things. When it comes time to tackle those big uncertain things, mm-hmm. it's going to feel even more wobbly. So I think right. that is a big challenge for the upcoming generation. I'm sure like it will be handled. Every generation looks at the generation behind them
right.
and yes. says, "Oh, kids today." Oh,
yeah, exactly.
That's what I keep saying to myself.
Absolutely. But at the same time, I too am not envious. I think growing up with social media is really hard because social media is 24/7 judgment. In yes. public. I mean, the yes. likes and your followers are enumerated. There's a number and everybody can see it. And so social media is driven by comparison. Oh. And so we all know at this point that social media is the highlight reel of people's lives. You know, we know that nobody is going to post, picking up tampons on sale or cleaning the cat's litter box. You know, nobody posts right. the mundane aspects of right. their life. But it's really hard not to compare. And when we do compare, we inevitably end up feeling inadequate or like something is wrong with us, which is that fatal flaw. That's the heart of social anxiety.
And they're growing up in this. I mean, this is their world from day one.
Exactly. I can't even so sad.
I mean, do you remember we used to just have slumber parties and in our sweats and like no makeup on?
Yeah.
And, and I feel like, especially girls, you know, from 14, 12 even, they're so aware of their looks and their makeup and what clothes they're wearing. And that I had no idea. My eyebrows were one. I mean, I did not, I had no clue. I mean, right. somebody had to teach me about waxing, like all these things. I'm Greek, you know, we need to wax. But I'm like, God, these girls, their face looks perfect and they look like they're 25. And when do they just sit around and eat cookie dough? Like we used to.
Well, because think about it, there's always a camera. So they always have totally. To be camera ready.
Oh my God. Exactly. Yeah. They're in all the filters and oh my God.
The filters, yeah.
And then you see them in person. You're like, oh, okay.
Right.
That's not you.
So we are talking with Dr. Ellen Hendrickson. She is the author of How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic, and Rise Above Social Anxiety. By the way, I love the cover of this book. It's so adorable.
It is.
It's just so perfect. It's this girl or woman basically hiding behind balloons, but it's just like it's perfect because it's like that's how you feel
kind
at a party.
Sad.
Yeah, exactly. At a party, you know, in this social environment, you're just so uncomfortable. And, you know, it's interesting because I guess I never really had social anxiety, but I can imagine how crippling that would be and to feel. And my husband is an introvert, and he gets social anxiety. He feels very uncomfortable. Like, he feels like to make small talk is like, you know, is like water torture.
That's
like,
why
like,
he steals cars when people are. That's an inside joke.
Exactly. But I can imagine how crippling that is. And so I'm wondering, Ellen, if you can kind of – maybe there's a couple tips that you can give for people, you know, going to a party or who are terrified to enter this situation.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought up the cover. I love the cover myself as well, because somebody pointed out to me, actually, I won't take credit for this, that the woman on the cover who's hiding behind the balloon is in a party dress. Like, she's out there.
Yeah.
She's trying.
Right.
You know, she's, like, not at home under a blanket. And
yes.
so I appreciate that she, you know, has gotten dressed up and is going out there to give it a shot.
Right.
So I like that message that it sends as well.
Mm-hmm.
As for tips, yes, absolutely. There are lots of things to do. So let's see. I think a really good one that I like to offer is to turn our attention inside out. So when we're in a socially anxious moment, our attention naturally turns inward and we start monitoring our performance. So we think, like, why did I just say that? I hope I don't sound like an idiot. Mm-hmm. Or, like, oh, I hope they don't see my hand is shaking. Or, like, should I stand this way or this way to look casual? You know, can they tell I'm nervous? Our attention just turns inward and we start to pay attention to, like, me.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens then is that our bandwidth gets eaten up and we have very little left over for listening and responding and attending to the moment. And so that's why we spill our wine and we trip, and, you know, not in a cute way.
Right.
And so to remedy this, what we can do is turn our attention from me to them. So to listen and look and focus outward.
Okay.
And that will ground us in the present and allow us to respond more naturally. So I'd say, like, rather than a lot of people who I work with will, in a conversation, will think of what to say as the other person is talking and will check it to make sure it sounds smart or doesn't sound idiotic. And then they just wait until it's their turn to say that thing. But then they come off as distracted or preoccupied. And so what we practice doing in session is to use that energy instead to listen to what the other person is saying and to respond based on that,
right,
rather than pre-planning and checking in one's head.
Yeah.
So that's one thing to do. Turn your attention inside out.
It reminds me of, like,
another thing I love to think. Oh, go ahead.
No,
sorry.
I was just gonna make a joke how it's like, you know, enough about me. What do you think of me? You know, it's like turn your attention outward.
Right.
It's just funny. Right. But no, but I totally agree with that. To go on, yeah, we want to hear more. This is super helpful.
Yeah, no worries. So the second thing is to give yourself a role to play. And so this can be done, you know, formally. So, for instance, like if you're a member of an organization, like a well-kept secret, I think, is to try to take on a leadership role. Mm-hmm. And so that gives you a reason to talk to everybody, like a duty to fulfill. But it can totally be done informally. You can, you know, if you're going to a party, you could assign yourself the task of talking to three new people. If you're going to a networking event, you can give yourself the goal of, you know, getting three new business cards or numbers. It gives you a sense of purpose.
Yes.
And it takes away that biggest driver of anxiety, which is uncertainty. And so there's this lovely study that I like to turn into a story. So this is a study by Drs. Simon Thompson and Ron Rappe, and they are Australian researchers. And so they had this experiment where they asked women who were socially anxious and women who were, like, more kind of confidently chatty and outgoing than average. So the two ends of the spectrum. They had these two groups of women, like, one at a time, come into a waiting room and for an experiment, which, unbeknownst to them, started as soon as they walked into the room. And so they walked in, sat down, and then a research assistant who was pretending to be another participant came in and sat down with them and said, oh, hope we don't have to wait too long, and then just waited.
Mm.
And they wanted to see how these women would respond, if they would strike up conversation, if they'd ignore this guy, what would happen.
Uh-huh.
And so every 30 seconds for 5 minutes, this guy was prompted to just say another little comment and just see what they came up with. Okay, so this went on for 5 minutes. Then the researchers came in and they said, okay, welcome. Thank you both for coming. Your goal here is to get to know your conversation partner as well as you can in 5 minutes. Go. Okay, so now everybody had a structure. They had a goal. Mm. And so then they, you know, conversation ensued. And after these 10 minutes were over, these two different 5-minute chunks, they were rated on social competence. And the women with social anxiety in those first 5 minutes, it's not surprising that they rated quite low on social competence.
Mm-hmm.
But in the second 5 minutes, where they had some structure, they had an assignment, they were pretty much neck and neck with the women who were more outgoing than typical. And so just giving somebody an assignment, giving them a goal, giving them, you know, some structure to hang their hat on, can really improve, like, perceived social skills and social competence. It's not that we lack social skills if we have social anxiety. It's that we just need a way to organize them. We just need a way to put them towards a goal.
I
think that's a lovely example of how having a goal can really take away that anxiety.
That makes complete sense. But because then it's no longer about you. It's about this goal. It's like, oh, okay, let me just focus on the goal rather than I'm focused on, am I saying the right thing? Am I doing this right? It kind of turns your attention in a different direction.
Now I understand those mixer games at corporate functions.
Yeah, totally. Right, the icebreakers?
Yes, the icebreakers.
Exactly.
Wow. You have a task.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
And I guess.
And then finally, a last thing is to. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's okay. I'll ask my question after.
Oh, okay. Well, so, yeah. So a third thing is just to loosen up on the perfectionism. So, like, perfectionism is a huge driver of social anxiety. It's this sense of, like, all or nothing. So we often think that we have to drop, you know, this perfectly timed, witty comment into conversation. And so we stay silent. Or, you know, like at work, we think that the ideas we present in a work meeting, like, have to be, you know, like, these fully formed monologues. And so, again, we stay silent. And then someone else says our idea. And so, like, this, so, or we think we have to connect instantly with everyone. And so when we don't, we conclude that we're awkward, that it's our problem. And so the answer is to lower the bar, that it is okay not to speak in perfectly smooth, articulate paragraphs. Like, it's okay to have an awkward silence or two. And that I have this analogy that I like to use, like, social life isn't like a laser maze. You know, if you make one mistake, alarms are not going to go off all around you.
Right.
And so I think just being easier on ourselves and realizing it's not a performance or a test can help us loosen up and really be ourselves.
That makes total sense. Well, I guess how much of social anxiety do you feel like is related to, quote unquote, being shy or quiet? I'd love to hear kind of your interpretation about that.
Sure. Yeah. No, I'm glad you asked that. So, So 40% of people identify as shy. So that's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I would actually argue that social anxiety is pretty much normal. Like, social, like, shy is just the everyday way of saying socially anxious. However, if you change that question to, have you ever been shy? Mm-hmm. Like, were you shy as a child? Were you awkward as a teenager? 80% of people say yes. So, like, pretty much everybody can relate. Everybody has their insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are, you know, millions of people, so there's 13% of us here in America, for whom social anxiety gets in the way of living their life. That's when it crosses the line into a disorder.
Yeah. Right.
So, for instance, yeah. for, like, if we consciously forego 20% of our grade, because that's the class participation part, and we're thinking, I don't want to raise my hand. No, I'm going to do that. The max I can get is an 80 in this class. Or if we turn down a promotion because it would require us to give presentations and we just can't fathom the idea of speaking publicly,
right.
That's when it becomes a disorder because it gets in the way of living the life we want to live.
Sure.
But, you know, no matter where people fall on the continuum, whether they are, you know, shy or formerly shy or really can be diagnosed, you know, there is hope. And so those, for instance, those three things I talked about before are a nice start to letting go and building confidence. That also said, there is a difference between shyness and introversion.
Mm-hmm.
And I often hear those terms used interchangeably.
Yeah, right.
or as if like social anxiety is a more extreme form of introversion, but it's really like more, rather than it being like kind of tomato, they're really different. They're more like apple and orange, because introversion is about where you get your energy and how much stimulation you can handle. So introverts have to recharge and just get overstimulated very easily and recharge by being alone or one-on-one or like in a small group of trusted people.
Mm-hmm.
And extroverts often have never met a stranger. Like, they get their energy from people, from interacting, and have a much higher tolerance for stimulation, or even need the stimulation to not feel blah or, you know, bored.
Mm-hmm.
And so, while introversion and extroversion are about, you know, where you get your energy, are about stimulation, Social anxiety is about fear. It's worry over that reveal. And so it's right. It's absolutely possible to be a socially anxious extrovert. Mm-hmm. So an example I like to use, I was talking to this young man a couple of weeks ago, and he is a stand-up comic and a teacher. So he loves being in front of people. Like this yeah. this gives him his energy. But he is deathly afraid that they are judging him. Mm-hmm. So he's really between this rock and a hard place
yeah.
where he gets his energy from people, but is scared of them.
Yeah.
And that's a really hard place to be.
Oh, and yeah. what he's chosen to do.
I know. He's like,
he's certainly not hiding from it.
Right, yeah. exactly. It's great.
He's
yeah.
doing it.
Yeah,
yeah he's good living for him. The dream.
You know, you mentioned insecurities and everybody has them. Why, as people, are we hardwired to have insecurities? Like, I look at my dog, who Kelly knows very well, better than most, and he's a pit bull mastiff. He's the sweetest thing in the world, but he just walks into the room anywhere we are, and that dog has zero insecurities.
Right.
I mean, I'm not... Like, why can't we all be like
yes.
that? But I'm joking about the dog. But really, I feel like we all have them. And what is it with humans that we are hardwired that way?
Yeah, no, we all have an inner critic. Absolutely. Well, maybe there are some of us who don't have an inner critic. But
right.
I think so. But a total lack of insecurity
what's an inner
is actually
critic?
Kind of things gone wrong, right? Like if you have no insecurity, like that's being a narcissist or that's
yes,
being a psychopath, right?
Right?
Like that is not what we're going for. So
yeah.
in general, I'd say for the 99%, insecurity is part of the human condition, and it is actually necessary because a healthy dose of self-doubt helps us monitor ourselves. Helps us monitor our behavior. It's necessary to spark introspection,
mm-hmm.
and it motivates us to grow and change. And so I like to say that we doubt ourselves in order to check ourselves. Like, we doubt ourselves to keep ourselves in line, and because we are social animals, like we're wired to work together in a group, it ultimately helps us get along better with our fellow humans. And so a little bit of insecurity is necessary to kind of keep the social machine humming, and too much certainly gets in our way individually. But in terms of nature, in terms of Darwinism, it would rather have us have an overly sensitive social smoke detector that goes off when there is not actually a threat. Like that doesn't cost us anything. As opposed to one that never goes off because then our house
sure.
burns down
right.
socially.
That's
so
a great
that's,
way to look
that's
at it.
Why yeah. it sticks around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's great.
I have a lot of clients who come to my office and they say, I have no confidence. And I'm curious how you
what?
Would answer that. Yeah. They'd say, I have no confidence. Like I.
Oh, I thought they were saying you have no confidence.
No,
I was like, what? What? That's weird.
No. They're talking about themselves saying, hey,
okay,
I
got
need
it.
Help.
Sorry.
I have no confidence. I have no self-esteem. Are there exercises or, you know, tips you have on that front?
Well, I think that, again, there's that idea of trying to put action before confidence. It's kind of the same as that. So I work with people with depression as well. And oftentimes they will say, like, I'm not motivated. I just don't want to do anything. Like, it doesn't get anything for me. And so, I think we often feel like we have to feel like doing something before we do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have to feel like going to the gym before we go exercise, or we have to feel inspired before we sit down to write our great American novel or whatever. And so I think there we flip it as well. And so we put behavior before motivation. Like we lace up our shoes and we go to the gym, or we sit down and just start typing, and eventually inspiration strikes. And so we put action before motivation, and then our motivation catches up. So it's the same thing with confidence, to do something that's a little bit hard, that we're a little bit scared of. And once we have that experience under our belt, that's where the confidence comes from. So rather than waiting for lightning to strike and to feel confident or feel ready to do things before we're entirely ready. So I think that's an important lesson to convey.
It's that great saying, act your way into right thinking. And I love that because
it's take it till you make it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. That makes total sense.
And it's not. And I think it's important to tell the people we work with and ourselves that it's not that we'll never get anxious again. Like, of course we're going to be anxious.
Sure.
Of course we're going to have moments where we doubt ourselves. But if we can get ourselves to the point where it doesn't control us, that's where we want to be. So if we can get ourselves to the point where we can choose what we do rather than letting our fear choose for us, then we have it made. So, like, for me, you know, I've overcome a fair bit of social anxiety myself. Like, I was definitely one of those kids who did not raise her hand in class. For a long time, my wardrobe was pretty much restricted to, like, gray, black, and blue. Like, I had this idea that, like, bright colors would, like, I would be noticed. People would see me. Oh, my goodness. I wouldn't buy shoes that, like, click-clacked on the floor because I thought it would draw too much attention. And then I've definitely overcome all those things, but I still have my moments. Like, I get kind of oddly formal around authority figures. I don't love being on camera. It kind of makes me nervous. I do not like conflict. But, you know, when push comes to shove, I can do it. Like, I can do an on-camera interview. I can ask for a raise or go, like, if I'm in the elevator with my boss's boss, like, I can suck it up and chit-chat. Like, it's not that I don't get anxious in those situations, but I know enough of what to do, and I can use the skills that I teach in the book. Like, I'm not only the author, I'm also a client, you know, and I can choose what I do rather than letting that fear choose for me, which is what it had done in the past.
Makes sense.
Right.
Yeah. So I love this because, you know, obviously the title of your book, How to Be Yourself. Again, we're talking about Dr. Ellen Hendrickson. So everyone says that, like, just be yourself. And, you know, I love how, you know, one of the questions posed was like, well, why should you do it anyway? It's hard to hear, and it might be, you know, bad advice, but why do you feel like people should just do that anyway?
Why do I feel like people should do the things that they're not quite ready to do?
Or just to be
yourself?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think so. I'm really glad you asked that, actually, because I guess two things. One is that how to be yourself is, or just be yourself, excuse me, is kind of is in one respect terrible advice, because it implies, like, oh, well, why hadn't I just thought of that? You know, or is that all I need to do? It's not that easy, right? We can't just flip a switch and be ourselves. But at the same time, if we define, you know, your true self as the self you are without fear, that's definitely what we're going for. That's absolutely what we want to accomplish. Yeah. So even though, you know, we've all been in that scenario, like the first day of school or before a date where some well-meaning person gives us the advice, oh, just be yourself. And it feels so frustrating, but at the same time, it's really true to stop trying to hide and to conceal and to, not try to channel somebody else, but to just be who we are and to realize that that is sufficient. So I think that's really important. I think also that in terms of just being yourself, let's turn that around. And it's a nice way to help friends who have social anxiety, and to encourage them to be themselves. So I always like to say that a good therapist is like a good bra. They both push and support you.
Oh, I love that.
I think that
that's great.
That certainly as friends, we're not their therapists. We don't want to put on that hat in our friendship.
Right.
But I think those same principles of push and support apply, you know, so their anxiety is real. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we tell them, oh, just be yourself, I think it's important to not just stop there, but to, you know, to support them and respect their very real fears.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, to encourage them to stretch and grow, you know, try things that are just outside their comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And so I think statements like, don't worry about it, or you'll be fine, you know, always end up feeling kind of invalidating. And that's how, you know, just be yourself at its worst can come across. But instead, I think a nice way to support somebody with social anxiety is to tell the truth and emphasize how capable they are, to say things like, the first few minutes are the hardest. Mm. Or like, well, okay, last time you stuck with this, you were glad you did it. or right. You're strong and you can get through this. Mm-hmm. And also to just counter, their inner critic, like whatever voice is telling them they have this fatal flaw, is just giving them some heartfelt affirmation. I'm so happy you decided to come with me to this party. I really appreciate your company. And so, rather than kind of brushing aside the worry, to really tell the truth and to talk about their capability and how glad you are that they are out there at trying.
You know what? It's funny. I kind of have an example of that happened at a party my husband and I recently had. We had a dinner party, and there was one girl in particular. We didn't really know anybody at the party that well, and that was the point of the party. It was fun to kind of get these walks of different life together and see what happened. We like to experiment that way. So there was one girl in particular who, she is a musician. She's well accomplished, and I won't say without giving her identity away, but she came up to me in the kitchen and said, "Oh my God, I said the dumbest thing. I'm so sorry I said that." And it was, 2 minutes prior when I was talking to her with a group of people. And I said, "What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
And she goes, "Oh, well, I said this. And then you said this. And I should have just let it go. And I said something really dumb." And I go, "Oh my God, are you kidding? Don't worry about it." Right. I said, exactly. "Don't worry about it." But then I realized, she goes, and then she stopped me and she said, "I have major social anxiety."
Wow.
And it was crazy. And I thought, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." And I immediately switched gears. And so I said, okay, I have all these people that I have to tend to. But I thought, I know who I can introduce her to. Mm-hmm. She was a neighbor of mine who is so kind of, very mellow, very sweet. There was a lot of extroverts there. And I thought this was the perfect person to introduce her to.
Uh-huh.
And I did. And they became like fast friends.
Oh, really?
I mean, they just loved each other. But it was interesting to me who I kind of work, if there's a party, I don't feel shy about going to anybody. I don't have a shy bone in your body. I don't always have a filter, but I'm being myself. Right. I felt really bad for her. But I wanted to help her. And so I took her over there and she had a great time and she thanked me later. And I said, "How are you feeling?" And she goes, "Oh, I'm feeling so much better." She was the perfect person I needed to talk to. So it was just interesting having that happen literally right in front of me. And that was just a couple weeks ago. So that resonated what you were saying, Alan.
That's awesome. I'm so glad you were able to switch gears and, and could help her once you knew her story. And so, I think that's amazing. I'm glad she came to the party,
given that she said she was
hesitant.
You
didn't know the people there. She clearly didn't know the people there. So good for her.
Was so brave to just say it.
Yes,
and she's probably 15 years younger than me.
Oh,
that's why I asked you at the top of our conversation, is this a maturity thing too? Because she said she's really been struggling with standing up for herself. And I said, "Don't worry, honey. You're going to grow into it. You're going to stand up for yourself.
I'll do it for you.
Yeah.
If
just
you need.
Call me."
Exactly. Well, you're not going to believe this, Ellen, but we're almost out of time. So I wanted to make sure.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I know. I can't believe it. In the last minute or so, if you felt like, you wanted to say any last words, or we didn't cover anything that you felt that you wanted
to
talk about.
Sure. So my final word. No. So I guess the only thing I think I would want to get across is that social anxiety is definitely not all bad, that it is a package deal, and it can often come bundled with some real strengths. But people with social anxiety often have really high standards, and they're often really empathetic. Mm-hmm. They are altruistic, they're good listeners, they're conscientious, and they work hard to get along with people in an increasingly, diverse and global world. And so I think for the people who do have social anxiety, who are listening to your show, to take heart and to know that even as they work on their social anxiety and gain confidence, that those strengths don't go away even as their social anxiety does.
That makes complete sense. You were so wonderful. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Dr. Ellen Hendrickson. She's the author of How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic, and Rise Above Social Anxiety. And you can find her on her website at www.ellenhendrickson.com, and the last name is Hendrickson. Thank you so much. Really, really super fascinating topic. You were great.
Thank you. This was super fun. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you
Thanks,
so
Ellen.
Much. So next week, we're going to have, ooh, God, you should be here for this one. Carolyn Hauser, Blossom, Seven Steps to Sexual Healing.
Wow.
Very exciting.
I'll be back.
Yeah, exactly. So follow us on Instagram at 2TWOShrinks or on our Facebook, The Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show. A huge thank you to Kathy Lewis Edgerton, who's amazing, my good friend, Aww. My non-shy bestie. And yeah, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
All right. See you guys next week.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.